Go!
Okay, so welcome to the Bad Idea Podcast. I'm Steve Carlson.
And I'm Simon Abrams.
Bum, bum, bum! And this week we are discussing Herschel Gordon Lewis.
Discussing, that's a very liberal use of that word.
Yeah, we may run a bit long here because I think this is the first topic we've ever actually disagreed about.
Oh, vehemently, yes.
But this week's topic was occasioned by the documentary commissioned by Something Weird, which is currently playing at the Anthology Film Archives, Herschel Gordon Lewis, The Godfather of Gore.
Yes, that's co-directed by, it's Frank Henenlotter, is it? Something Marion. What's the guy's name?
I think it's like Billy something.
I'd just like to take a moment, though, to thank the Anthology Film Archives for generously providing screeners for what they're screening this weekend, and by extension, I guess, Something Weird Video for helping us out. It's been a great help. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. So yeah, we'll be talking about the films that are playing in that that particular retro as kind of representative of Lewis's whole oeuvre, I suppose.
But not limited to that as well, because naturally there are some things that that retrospective, which is over a span of 3 days, can emphasize, and there are just a couple that weren't, like 2000 Maniacs, for instance.
Yeah. And then we'll also kind of touch on the influence he's had on later filmmakers.
Right.
By examining a couple of films that are clearly indebted to him.
Which I think brings us, or we should start with, the Herschel Gordon Lewis documentary, Godfather of Gore. One of the things I take great issue with in this film is its narrow focus. This movie, I wrote a review for The House Next Door, but basically my beef with the film is that the focus of the film is that it's very much about the lived production history and experience of watching these films. It's a very skimpy level of context in terms of why Herschel Gordon Lewis's movie matters in the first place. I mean, it's especially hard to emphasize the importance of this filmmaker when a lot of the talking head footage of Lewis is him basically building the case against himself. Like, he's actively telling you, and this is part of the Herschel Gordon Lewis charm, naturally, but he's actively telling you that the movies that he made, he excreted onto the screen. He famously said about how he pities anyone that considers movie making an art form and that it's a business. He is essentially a person that embodies very much like the what I like to call, like, he's very much a grindhouse hustler. He knows...
He's a huckster.
He knows full well that what he's providing is just fool's gold. It's nothing more than the very basic level of entertainment, lowest common denominator taken to the extreme. And in that sense, it's really hard for me to watch it and just blindly accept the idea that, like, you know, the talking head footage in this film is a lot of people talking about what it was like making the movies, what it was like, and why people tentatively like it. I mean, they mention that he's big in France, apparently, but they don't mention or feature any French critics' take on the films. It's pretty much the only critical and cultural context you get for this film is John Waters and Joe Bob Riggs.
And Frank Henenlotter.
Henenlotter does some good talking head.
And Henenlotter's quite open about the films he doesn't like and the ones he does like.
Right, yeah, his commentary about the Nudie Cuties, that they're totally useless films,
And you also have to keep in mind that Henenlotter's saying this even though this may take bread off his table, because he has an arrangement with Something Weird.
Right.
Where there's a number of films that come out under his banner, Frank Henenlotter's Sexy Shockers from the Vault.
Right.
And, essentially insulting a lot of the films under that Nudie Cutie banner, he's insulting a lot of the product he's pushing.
But that's the thing, like, that's the angle of the film. It's basically pushing the anti-mystique of Herschel Gordon Lewis, a filmmaker who is, he just happened to be the first guy through the door in terms of creating the gore genre, subgenre of horror movies.
He's far more lucky than good, but the point is that what I kind of admire about him isn't necessarily that he made a good film, it's that he was the first there. He was the first one to recognize the market. It's an important thing to be the first guy through the door. You don't have to be the best guy.
Yeah, but that basically implies that because there's no there in these movies, that there's no substance to them, that there's no way to approach them in any kind of analytical terms. It's basically shrugging your shoulders and saying, well, I can't touch this film in any terms beyond the most tentative. Like, there's no actual, like, gauging of what people that were watching these movies, other than the John Waters stuff who talks about passion pits and drive-ins, there's no actual way to know if these people were in fact buying the bait that he was selling. Like, were they actually really that titillated by this stuff? Like, they tentatively mentioned that movies like Blood Feast, which is now it's largely considered to be the first historic gore film, a film that he created the term gore in association with, or was the first person to associate with a horror film. Hmm. There's no real way to know that, you know, the weeks that it played wherever in Florida or in the different little trashy drive-ins, if these people were actually, like, rabid for it, or if it was, like, just a projection of the people that were drive-ins, if he was just, like, pushing it actively through the gate because he was so sure that he had something new.
You can do that for a one-week wonder. You know, I mean, for the FOWO type phenomenon for 1 week only. But if something's going to run, like he mentions a theater in, was it Chicago, I think, where it ran for 9 weeks. Mm. And at that point, if you have something that runs for 9 weeks, you're clearly going off more than just curiosity. You're getting word of mouth there.
It's true.
And whether or not you're getting, people who genuinely like it, or people who are liking it ironically, or going, this is the worst thing ever, you have to see it.
Yes.
It's, you're still getting butts in the seats. And that's kind of what, I'm not going to defend Lewis as an artist. I like his films a lot. I like some of his films a lot. Some of his films are truly awful, and we'll get to one of them later. But, I kind of forgot where I was going with that. But,
ladies and gentlemen, Steve Carlson.
Oh yes. No, the point I was trying to make is that there's a when you sign on for a Lewis film these days, at least there's a certain, and I think that kind of applies to the narrow focus you're kind of appending to the documentary here, and that there is a level of that in the film, and that if you're going to watch a film about Herschel Gordon Lewis, you know who he is. This film isn't really bringing in converts, but that's kind of the point. If you sit down to watch Blood Feast today, you know what you're getting into. There's 40 years of history here. Mm. that you're not sitting down looking at this going, this is going to be Citizen Kane.
Yeah, but at the same time, you have to wonder, because, like, within that insular sort of framework, how do more converts get made? You have to consider, from my point of view, in the sense that, like, if there's any way that you could possibly hook new viewers, it would be with a documentary about why this man is so important. And on some level, I would imagine, in my opinion, this is the kind of movie that, like, people that do know who Lewis's films, what they're in for. If they're going to try to get friends of theirs that don't know what they're in for when they watch these movies, they would, you know, oh, hey, come along. You like horror movies, or you like stupid shit. You like whatever, fill in the blank. Come with me to see this film.
But at the same time, if this documentary built up Lewis as a great treasure and a gift to the cinematic world,
but it doesn't,
and then you sit down and watch Blood Feast,
it doesn't have to. That creates a false dichotomy. It's like basically implying that if you can't sell him as the low artist that he is, it's because the alternative would be that you'd have to try to sell him as an artist. Part of me is tempted to say that I am very curious what the French critics that he's alluding to in the film, who like his films and try to sell him as an auteur, have to say. But another part of me just wants to know what, like, a guy like Joe Bob Briggs, who they use very sparingly in the film.
Surprisingly, because he's kind of a big champion of these sorts of films.
Exactly. And I want to know, like, he seems to have the familiarity with the films in the first place. He just seems to know, and I would bet if you were to engage him with a conversation, he would be able to tell you what the movies were, how they were responded to, what is so novel about them, what, beyond just, like, the level of, like, oh yeah, I was a real ball buster on set, only one take all the time, I beat these women practically. And it, it's like, it's shit like that that it just, it builds up to the point where it's valorizing all the wrong stuff. It's valorizing basically the shittiness of it. Like, in, by that logic, you can make an awesome documentary about Ted V. Mickles or whatever trashy, like, well, Lee Cardona. Or I mean, just like,
I think there's a great documentary to be made about Rene Cardona, incidentally. But
I mean, our Ted V. Mickles, I mean, would you tell me that there is a great documentary made about him?
Probably not, but then again, I'm relatively unfamiliar with Mickles' work. So.
I've only seen The Corpse Grinders, and that's all I fucking need to see. I saw them when the Two Boots Pioneer was still playing, and hoo doggy, they got him on the phone, and they had a post-screening Q&A with him, and some fans were like, These are people that were exposed to his work through Mystery Science Theater 3000, and they were like gleefully pointing out how obsessed they were with The Girl with the Golden Boots and the soundtrack of that. Like, yeah, man, I drive around all the time with that soundtrack playing, and
yeah,
it's like,
well,
how does one respond to that?
Mystery Science Theater 3000 has created a whole other level of fandom that I have issues with, but that's. Okay. Well, that's not enough time to get into that.
But yeah, let's talk about her.
But
let's talk about Lewis's films in general.
Anyway, the thing I think you're kind of approaching this from a modern perspective,
mm-hmm.
and you have to kind of look at where Lewis fits in the perspective of the time he was in, and maybe the documentary doesn't do as good a job as I think it does bring that out. I think at least in terms of Blood Feast, the film does a pretty good job about setting up the kind of market he was in,
mm-hmm.
what with the, you know, the nudie cuties and nudist camp films and how he was working through that, and you know how that genre was kind of burning itself out and he needed to find something new,
mm-hmm.
and if you can't bring out nudies, hit the blood, you know. But there's because his producing partner, David F. Friedman, who's interviewed several times in the film.
Yeah.
And who just unfortunately died recently. He has a famous quote where he talks about the marketing he did in a lot of the films he did, which a lot of them are terrible. But some of them are good. A lot of them are awful. And he has a famous quote where he says, the point is not to sell the steak, but the sizzle. So when they get into the theater, they realize there's no steak there, but the sizzle smelled so good.
In that sense, again, you have to sell me on the fact that in this documentary, the sizzle is basically the fact that we are looking from it from a modern perspective, and we know that there's no steak, basically, that there's nothing but, like, you know, a rinky-dink hamburger patty that's been left out in the sun for a couple days. It's like, what's the appeal, basically, the carny factor, basically.
Mm.
He is basically positioned as the King Carny, and unfortunately, like, part of me is like, well, you could have any number of carnival barkers. Why him? Why him beyond the fact that he was the first?
And he was also the most financially successful.
Well, again,
and
they don't go into that at all.
And extremely prodigious in his output for a number of years. From 63 to 1971, he made something like 60 films.
But if your focus, and the film's focus, is the fact that he was the godfather of gore, that he's the,
I do think the film kind of fails on that level.
Mm-hmm.
I like it overall, but I think it does fail when you get past Color Me Blood Red.
Right.
And the Friedman-Lewis partnership dissolves. And it wanders around kind of cherry-picking from little bits of the remainder of Lewis's filmography. Where, you know, stopping wherever it feels, well, this might be interesting, or this might be interesting. But then again, Lewis did that in his own filmography. I mean, if you look at everything he did post the Blood Trilogy, I mean, it's just this hodgepodge of genre, like where he was just working to work a lot of times. Like, oh, I have this idea. Let's knock it out. I got a couple days.
Right.
So, you know.
But, yeah, let's start talking about the Blood Trilogy. I know when I think the first Lewis film that I saw was one of the post Blood Trilogy films, The Wizard of Gore.
Mm.
But
which in its own way is kind of brilliant, I think. But
Blood Feast is actually I would say that of the ones that I've seen of that, like, of the gore films of his, that's the one I would probably say is the most palatable. And then again, I haven't seen Color Me Blood Red. It's simplicity. The simplicity of Blood Feast is really kind of what its own appeal is. But then again,
Color Me Blood Red is kind of interesting metaphorically.
Right.
It's about an artist who starts using blood.
Blood, yeah.
But artistically, it's very silly. And it's, in light of the other two entries in the trilogy, it's kind of redundant.
Right.
I mean, I enjoy it, but it's definitely a step down from the other two.
Right. No, but... Sorry for the interruption, folks. Talking about Herschel Gordon Lewis is apparently more taxing than we thought.
Yeah.
We were having recording difficulties with my recorder.
Anyway, we're talking about the chick with the enormous mouth.
Yes. So in that scene, that's one of the few scenes in a Lewis film that, in terms of blood, it's, like, blocked competently. It's filmed in such a way that I can kind of actually see why there might be, if he weren't just happened to be the first guy to do the gore thing, why he just might be worth paying attention to. Like, there, the scene is just interesting in terms of, like, the way that once the tongue is out, there's blood slowly oozing out of her mouth. She's cross-eyed. Her mouth is wide open, and her hair is... Her perfectly coiffed hair is... it has a bump in it. So it's just, like, this perfect sort of evisceration of, like, pin-up culture. And more accurately, it's a way of embracing it and basically turning it into this new thing. Hmm. This idea of, you know, the, as John Waters said, this pornographic level of violence.
But I think there's a level where Lewis even plays with that. I mean, look at the opening scene. You have a woman coming home, you know, walking around her apartment, taking off her clothes, getting into a bath. It's shot like one of Lewis's nudie cuties. The grammar is straight out of something like The Adventures of Lucky Pierre or Boing or something like that. And then all of a sudden, Mal Arnold comes in and saws her leg off with no warning whatsoever.
And I have to admit, the red squid paint that they use in that film is a nice, lurid red color.
Yeah, it's a lot more interesting than a lot of the gore scenes you get today because, you know, they work with that sort of motor oil crimson that just they're aiming for realism, but it's just not kicking, is it?
Well, that's the thing. They're not. Are they really aiming for realism at that point? You have to just ask whether it was just, if they had the means to do computer-generated imagery, if they would have gone for that. I mean, obviously, it would be more expensive.
I'm talking about the current crop of blood. I mean, obviously, the red paint.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. If you're going to make that comparison, you have to consider the fact that back then they weren't trying for...
Well, no, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, today, the shades are supposed to be more real, but no. Yeah. No, back then it was like, here's some red paint, you know, go for it, whatever. But,
Yeah, which brings us to the next gore film, 2000 Maniacs.
Before we leave that, there's a shot when Arnold takes out her eye right at the beginning. There's a bit in it I like where he takes out her eye and it's sitting on the knife and he kind of looks at it and he has this look on his face like he can't believe what he's seeing. Mm. So the idea is you and the audience. Do you see what's going on the screen here? Even the actor can't believe it. We're just crazy. So I mean, it's not a great film, but I think there's a level in which they understood what they were doing in terms of the marketplace. I mean, it's a filmed product essentially. I mean, as in the documentary, Lewis has a line about the films he was making. What is it? It wasn't the greatest film, but it had sprocket holes and it could run through the machine.
That wasn't Lewis, that was Friedman, actually.
Was it Friedman?
Okay. That was Friedman, yeah.
But either way, I mean, they were both consciously making these films that could be sold.
But by that logic, and I think this is going to get to what I have a larger issue with in Lewis in general, by that token, just on the merits of the fact that it was a filmmaker that is in control of the little that he is, and the little ambition that he's trying to accomplish in his work. By that logic, you're basically excusing a lot of latter-day filmmakers who A, aren't important, or important in air quotes, or B, like just they could like we're talking about Alexander Aja, the filmmaker of the Hills Have Eyes remake, the Piranha 3D, High Tension. That guy could definitely tell you that he made Piranha 3D especially to give the audience what they want, because he knows what they want, and it's tits and ass and gore. And, like, the fact that he's sneering at you, as a lot of its defenders will say, doesn't necessarily imply a that much more cynical perspective, just a more conscious auteur or whatever.
Yeah, but, I mean, again, that gets into just the changing nature of the business. I mean, because, you know, we talk about Lewis like he was the only one doing this, and he wasn't.
Exactly.
This was a whole underground thing. The whole idea was to sell something that you couldn't get in Hollywood films at the time. And it didn't matter. It didn't matter if it actually delivered on the product. But, you know, you had Herschel Gordon Lewis, you had David Friedman, you had Lee Frost, who I think is, incidentally, far more talented than a lot of the other motherfuckers working in this, in that particular industry. If you've ever seen one of his films, he's quite formally interesting, actually. But you had him. I mean, you had Harry Novak produced, you know, distributing whatever junk he came up with. Every now and then he'd stumble across something interesting, but most of it is unwatchable garbage. Mm-hmm. There's no middle ground with Novak. But and so you had all these guys out here just making these movies that they knew because there was a need, there was a demand for product.
Right.
You had all these, you know, these second-run houses, these drive-ins. They were just throwing the movies out there, knowing they would sell. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't necessarily important if they were good. It was just a matter of something to put butts in seats. It's like it was like the rise of video in the 80s, where, you know, you had Gorgon Video and Lightning Video, Vestron Video, putting out all these forgotten exploitation things on video because, you know, they were the first people there. It was like you had to get something on the shelf, and there were only so many copies of the latest Paramount and Fox and Universal releases to go around. And, you know,
but once, does that once, mean they're worthy of, like, of well, valorizing, like, Lewis's?
In terms of historical import, I find them interesting.
Okay.
And every now and then you'll stumble across one that's genuinely artistically interesting as well.
I think it's...
But to bring that back to your comparison of AHA here, AHA, on the other hand, is doing this as a studio man on a studio dime. He's basically taking the lessons of the exploitation huckster and selling them to you in a $60 million package with an enormous... You know, he's basically making the film and getting a big studio to do to you for quite a lot more money what Lewis was doing on, you know, $7 in his pocket.
Couldn't we say that if Lewis had that kind of opportunity, he would leap at it?
No, he wouldn't. I think he would have done what he ended up doing eventually anyway. And gone into direct marketing.
But then again, that's the thing. Like,
and that's honestly why he got out of the business, because the big studio started playing his game.
Would you say then that he had more integrity in terms of his marketing sense? I mean, that's the thing. Like, that's where I start to look askance at you, like, because that implies that, like, he wanted a level of creative control or just marketing control that, like, I just don't. It doesn't compute with what. The image that I have in my head of Lewis.
Well, I think in terms of that, it is. Well, I think that yeah, in all level, yeah, because Lewis wasn't just the one making the films; he was the one marketing them as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you know, AHA's making the film; he's not marketing it. Mm-hmm. He's just making a lazy piece of shit and leaving it up to the studio to market it. Mm-hmm. Lewis, on the other hand, is at least honest enough to make a lazy piece of shit and then sell it to you.
Right.
Then, you know, not get someone else to do his dirty work. To come in and go, you know, yeah, I got this film, and you should come see it. And, yeah, 40 years on, he can admit, yeah, okay, it was a piece of shit. But people came to see it. And now it's gotten to the point where it has historical value.
Let's switch gears and talk about the next film in the Blood Trilogy, 2000 Maniacs.
2000 Maniacs.
Yeah, that one, to me, I know it's Lewis's favorite film of the movies he's made, as he says in Godfather of Gore, but to my mind, like, I don't know, there's something... at least strange and surreal enough about Blood Feast and hysterically bad in parts about it, especially Mal Arnold's performance and his Groucho Marx eyebrows. But
his on-again, off-again limp. And
his, like, aerosol can gray hair, which is supposed to make him look older.
And the horribly awkward dialogue.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Call the Fremonts, and for God's sake, don't let them eat anything!
But yeah, so 2000 Maniacs, speaking of don't let them eat anything, is a movie that, like, is, according to him, one of the cornerstones of the French critics, these imaginary French critics that are big boosters of his career, Lewis's career, they point to this film as an example of why Lewis is a vrai auteur, as they would say. And that's because he did everything in the film.
Just to add on here, I mean, the French will occasionally honor some things that are incredibly stupid.
Well, I mean, the
French also have held a gala for Lloyd Kaufman, whom I adore. I think he's an incredibly important filmmaker in modern day.
We'll podcast about him later, I'm sure.
Yeah, but that's getting off topic here.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying, just because you know the French like him doesn't necessarily mean they're great.
I know. What I'm saying is that what they did was basically they pointed to the fact that Lewis was so hands-on with the film, editing, directing,
composing,
composing, even singing the title song. But he totally tries to demystify that claim of auteurship by saying, "Well, I only sang the song because the guy that was supposed to sing the song couldn't, and I needed to get it done immediately." And
like his cameo in A Taste of Blood, where it was just kind of a thing of necessity,
right? So,
but I think 2000 Maniacs is a hoot.
Well, to me, like what
it's more openly competent than Blood Feast is.
But it's not. That's the thing. It's not as ballsy. Like to me, like it bites off more than it can chew in the premise of the film, which is that a bunch of Yankees wander into this southern town, and they are basically just taken advantage of by these people who want revenge from the North, and they're Confederate scum. But as the film's, is it an official sequel? I guess
no. It's a sanctified remake.
Okay,
but it's I don't think it's officially part of canon in the 2000 Maniacs universe.
Right, we're referring to 2001 Maniacs, a movie made in 2005, in 2000 or 2006, I think.
2005.
And yeah, that movie at least points out that the original 2000 Maniacs didn't really capitalize fully, I think, on the premise, which is that a bunch of racist white guys are taking advantage of the Northerners, and there's not a single black guy in the film. And that's because, as we were talking about earlier, Lewis didn't want to offend anyone. He knew that there was no money.
Well, he knew there were certain offenses he'd get away with and certain offenses he couldn't. Because a lot of his audience was going to be in drive-ins and movie theaters throughout the South, where there was a large base for exploitation. I mean, it always was, starting with the Roadshow films, going through the days of Kroger Babb and Dan Sonny, where you tour around with birth reels and shit.
But in that sense, would you really tell me that he's above race baiting? Like, you really want to tell me that, like, if didn't think he would get more money, he would totally just have them lynch a black guy?
In 1964, yes. You would definitely be above race baiting. I can't think of a single contemporaneous auteur who would have put that in their film. And the one time Roger Corman even attempted to broach the subject with The Intruder,
Shatner film,
it was one of his few flops because it was considered too hot button.
Right.
A lot of his meat and potatoes markets wouldn't touch the film. Mm. So he kind of, I'm assuming he alighted over that for monetary reasons.
Okay. But, well, let's get to what I think is...
Anyway, yeah.
If you're going to talk about Lewis's films, one of the films that I would say that I enjoyed the most, relatively speaking, of course, is Scum of the Earth, a movie that I know you're not too hot to trot on.
It's okay.
It's got a bizarre but weirdly compelling plot, I think. It's much more ambitious than Blood Feast or even something like Something Weird, which is such a half-formed, bizarro film that, like... You know, yeah, Steve's laughing at this. But, yeah, Scum of the Earth, like, has, like... It's got this level of complete misanthropy and abject misogyny in it that, like, I kind of love. Like, it talk about movies that bite off more than they can chew. This movie, like, takes at least three more mouthfuls in than 2000 Maniacs did. And I kind of love it. Like, there's one character in it that he's trying to explain why he's so sure that one character, a young college girl, is going to allow herself to be blackmailed into posing for nude photos. And
he
says...
The infamous down inside your dirty speech.
No, before this.
Oh, before that.
He says, cozy fan tutti, as Mozart said. And Mal Arnold, who's back from Blood Feast, says, what's that mean? And he says, it means that women are all alike. And it's like... First of all, I mean, I know Lewis was an educator and a professor, but, like, the fact that he's, like, jamming a Cosi fan tutti reference down this guy's throat is uncanny. Second of all, it's just, like, it's so surreal. Like,
yeah.
But that's the thing. It speaks to the film and his own mantra of anyone can do it. Anyone can take off their clothes in front of a camera. Anyone can shoot this stuff. Anyone can do it in a couple takes. Anyone can profit from it.
Yeah.
It's a totally mercenary attitude, but I think it perfectly reflects the aura that Lewis projected as a filmmaker.
I think you're getting at what is interesting about the film, that there is a level of self-awareness about it. Like, you have the the one line, our business is pleasure, let's do it in front of the camera,
right?
You know, I think because it there are times when it feels like it kind of a missive or apology, I guess, from Lewis, like, this is what I do, you know.
Well, it's not an apology.
Well,
it's more of a manifesto, if anything.
Yeah. And there's the photo shoot with Sandy where it's all you don't see her, you just see it from the male reaction to her. It's all set up as basically all male gaze.
But then no, actually that's not true, because there's the scenes shot from the perspective of her from on the stage, where you see what she's looking at, and she doesn't see anyone actually behind the camera.
No, I'm not talking about that one. I'm talking about the earlier photo shoot.
That's the thing. Like, that complicates it. It's a mirror image of it, I'm saying. You basically see the view from the stage shows nobody behind the camera, just a bunch of bright lights and a standalone tripod. And, like, again, that's totally just the Lewis attitude of, you know, set it up and go. Like, the fact that, you know, the cameraman is drinking, he takes a drink of red wine after saying, there's only one person in this world more disgusting than you.
Me.
Yeah. I think there's something refreshing about Scum of the Earth, because in that sense, like, the plot of watching this poor girl dig herself further into, like, blackmail by, like, posing for all these photos is just kind of refreshingly debased.
I think it's thematically an interesting film. I just think, story-wise and energy-wise, it's just dead. It seems to take its seedy setting a little too much to heart, and the film itself feels just seedy and worn down and just...
But the Lewis canon, though, you gotta admit, at this point, you have to, after a certain point, take what you can get, you know?
I don't know. See, in Lewis's better films, like in the Blood Trilogy, or in the Gore Girls, or in The Wizard of Gore, or in, you know, Gruesome Twosome, or even She-Devils on Wheels, which I generally hate, but I feel there's at least an energy there. You know, it's, you know, his particular shooting style, you know, get the shot, move on to the next setup, at least provides it with a sort of, just a movement, you know, because he's not sitting around, you know, having people talk in rooms all the time.
One of the things, though, before we move on, I love about Scum of the Earth, though, is, like, the totally inadvertent parallels that they give between it and Mal. Within Mal Arnold's character in Scum of the Earth and his character in Blood Feast, which is he's always taunting one of the girls that, what are you, the Queen of Sheba? You know, and it's such an important thing.
Then, of
course,
he shows up being Fuad Ramses.
Yeah, Fuad Ramses in Blood Feast. This guy obsessed with, hold on, it's called the Book of Ancient Weird Religious Rites.
Ancient Weird Religious Rites, yes.
And
the Ceremony of Ishtar.
Yes.
Reminds me, we totally should have seen Blood Diner, but we don't have... Blood Diner is amazing. It's like, if you haven't seen it, it's Blood Feast after taking a bunch of bad acid. It's incredible. Both you and anyone listening to this, if you haven't seen it, track it down. It's amazing.
There is literally
a woman who dies by having her head made into a giant donut. It's incredible.
Oh, that's... Okay, that at least sounds interesting.
It's incredible.
But the other thing with Mal Arnold that I like about Scum of the Earth is that, like, in Blood Feast, he is supposed to be, like, an old man. He's constantly saying, like, honor an old man's request. And he's got, as we alluded to, he's got gray hair sprayed on.
The spray paint gray hair.
But in Scum of the Earth, he's
only 17.
You forget, I'm a minor. And you know, really, Mal Arnold, a minor? This guy looks like he's at least 40.
But the thing is, they had to old him up for Blood Feast, according to the documentary, because the guy who they had hired actually was old, and then he flipped out. And Mal, at the time, who I don't think he was 17, but he wasn't much older. I mean, he was like, you know, I think in his mid 20s. Had to play an old dude,
right?
So you know.
But yeah, let's talk about where I think, if you're listening to this podcast and you don't know who Herschel Gordon Lewis is, where you'll probably most likely find the best argument for why he matters, which is namely the films that are take after him the most.
Yeah.
The first one we already alluded to.
So I guess we're not discussing something weird.
Let's not talk about that. We already live tweeted that, and I think that was already too many words spilled on that.
Something, suffice to say, all you need to know about Something Weird is it's a film about ESP and witches.
And ghosts. And ghosts. It rips off the man with X-ray eyes pretty mercilessly.
It does do that, and it's pretty awful and incoherent, and nobody ever really needs to see it. So
yeah,
so that's taken care of.
Yes, due diligence given. let's talk about 2001 Maniacs, the movie from 2006. I think for my money, that movie is better than 2000 Maniacs, or at least more entertaining, because not just on the level of storytelling craft, but there's just a level of fun to it. Like, it just seems like it's actually, the filmmakers are, you know, it wouldn't take much to be better than 2000 Maniacs, because
I don't see, that's the thing.
They're actually trying, basically.
I think there was a lot of fun in 2000 Maniacs as well. I think I adore it, man. It's a Southern fried hoot.
I don't know. That's the thing. Like with the remake, at least.
I mean, it's I wrote down. It's broad as a barn door, twice as red. But you know, sometimes I like that. So.
Well, that's the thing. The style of comedy totally didn't hit with me. Whereas, like, I know in 2001 Maniacs, you were totally like holding your ears while we were watching the bits with like college humor.
It took some doing for me to get into the film. I did eventually warm to it, and I think I said to you, it's what the Lewis film 2000 Maniacs would look like if it was made today, and I mean that as a compliment.
I know, now I do, at least. Yeah. But the part of me is like, well, you have to look at it this way, because, like, if you're taking that statement at face value, you have to wonder, with a movie like that, it wouldn't be the same, because 2001 Maniacs is just, on a surface level, at least trying to come up with clever ideas that reflect upon something else.
Well, the point is,
like, it's reflecting, as we were talking about, it's a fan service film, basically.
Basically.
There are a lot of references to the original film,
mm-hmm.
and even twists that play on the fact
mm-hmm.
that if you're watching this, you've probably already seen 2000 Maniacs and think you know what's going to happen, but they're going to fuck with you because you have
that. Because they understand your familiarity, because they've seen the film too.
Exactly. And I think I enjoy that. I think it's relatively a more sophisticated film, level of humor. I think even the frat boy stuff has a relative sophistication to it when you compare it to, you know, Dadgum! I love this stuff!
what bothered me about it initially was that, like, you know, yeah, the Dadgum stuff is corn pone. But it's honest. It's clearly, you know, it works, I think. And the stuff at the beginning, it just struck me as something that has scare quotes all around it. Like, look at these douchebags! Aren't you going to be happy to see them die? You don't want to actually spend time in their company, do you? Because they're douchebags.
Well, that's the thing.
It's something I find endemic in a lot of horror filmmaking these days, where you make your characters as obnoxious as possible. So that you don't mind when they get horribly splattered later on.
I think this is what I like about Severance that you don't like, and I think that I like about 2001 Maniacs, which is they start off as completely unpleasant, but in that sense, what they both this film, 2001 Maniacs, and Severance get right is that they know that what's going to endear you to them isn't their personalities. It's the situation they're thrown into. Mm. And I think the turn for you...
I think 2001 Maniacs does pull that off.
Exactly.
In that the lead character does gradually become sympathetic.
Because I think in that sense the emphasis gets pulled away from showing you who is being put in peril and on the peril itself, which happens to be like this hickish town.
Yeah.
That happens to be scary in a Robin Hardy, Wicker Man kind of way. Mm. You know, it's not overtly scary, but it is... scary in a surreal kind of way.
If you can put yourself in that situation, you
yes,
would. Yeah,
it's much easier, I think, to get your head into that mentality. Yeah. I think
the value of 2001 Maniacs in that not just as a decent homage to Lewis, which it is, but it kind of, I guess, updates that sensibility to kind of touch on things that Lewis couldn't have touched on in his day. Like, for instance, the racial angle, which we spoke about earlier. There's a black fellow and his half Chinese, I believe, girlfriend in the film, and they become fairly important characters. And the racial angle does get played up a lot. Robert Englund plays the lead in 2001 Maniacs, and he's like the mayor of this hick town, and he has expresses quite vocally some issues about. Kowtowing to a black man,
right?
But the film plays off it quite nicely. I mean, his death scene is played with him compressed on a bed of cotton.
Yeah,
literally, there's this picked cotton, and it's pretty ballsy. But there's something more interesting going on there, even than that, I think, in that it's something that was alluded to with a couple of the deaths in 2000 Maniacs, just the idea of desire going wrong. But it reaches a full flower in this film, where just sexuality is horrid and perverse, and it all goes wrong, and it's terrible.
And nobody gets any, basically.
Yeah.
And if they do, you're either not seeing it, or it's just, like, basically totally perceived. Like, I think the couple that gets it on successfully is the two gay guys, and, like, the only thing that's visualized of their, like, night of love is, like, their... drinking, and one of them's in their pajamas, and they're like just sitting there together.
Well, the hero and the heroine get it on too, but
which one?
The main guy with the spiky hair and the blonde.
I totally don't remember.
They got it on.
Okay,
but yeah, like one of the characters is hanging out with these two blonde cousins who keep having lesbian encounters with each other and not letting him do anything.
Right. They even refuse him the ability to actually just masturbate quietly. Yeah. Not even quietly, but he's a little noisy. But masturbating while just sitting over there watching him.
He's not allowed to do anything.
Yeah.
Then there's the other guy.
Oh, wait, no, the black guy and the Asian chick have sex.
Yeah, they do. That's right. But their sex is not normal sex. It's S&M sex.
Right, right. So yeah,
it's desire perverted, essentially.
It's basically phrased as deviant sex.
Yeah.
In other words.
Yeah. And
even the gay sex is
it's totally supposedly... totally phrased as deviant sex.
Yeah.
And think about how the gay guy dies.
Right. Yeah. With the Edward II type killing.
Impaled right through. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely meant as a little nudge there.
Right.
But even with the dude who the one dude who's alone and has the milkmaid come up to his room. What does she say when she's feeding him the acidic moonshine? Suck it, Mr. Man!
Yeah.
It's clearly kind of flipped as a reversal of traditional male-female, horror sex dynamics.
Absolutely.
So.
But yeah, this brings me to another, what I think, a really... good example of why Lewis's children are actually a lot more interesting than Lewis himself. Smash Cut, which is a movie by Lee Gordon. I'm introing Lee Gordon, Jim Marbury, the director of Jesus Christ Vampire Hunter,
which is great if you haven't seen it.
Oh my gosh, you have to!
It's great.
But yeah, Smash Cut is pretty darn good too.
I wouldn't disagree with your statement here about Lewis's influence being more important than Lewis himself.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say there. I have no disagreement there.
Okay.
I like a lot of Lewis's films, but again, I see him more as an influence. Blood Feast is the blueprint.
Mm-hmm.
Go build off it. You know? Do something with it. He's allowed you to work with this new cinematic language.
It's the shittiest blueprint for a house. I would hate someone to actually use that.
Build that house.
Yeah.
I would totally live in that house. Are you kidding?
Bob Vila would shrink back in horror. I can't do anything with it.
I would live the hell out of that house, man.
You would not. There'd be no floor.
Oh, I'd find a floor.
Warped floorboards. There'd be like a bathroom on the ceiling.
Yeah, don't you want your neighbors to see you when you bathe?
Hey, guys. No, anyway, the smash cut. Smash cut, I really adore because, like, you have to take it from the point of view of what he's doing with his character, who the main character is a Herschel Gordon Lewis sort of stand-in from a very perverse angle. His name is Abel Whitman, played by David Hess, who's rather good in a Tony Franciosa a la Tenebrae kind of way.
It's an interesting twist on his usual sniveling 70s psycho type.
Yes.
Which, you know, if you've seen him at all, you know him from Last House on the Left.
Yes, yes. But yeah, he plays Abel Whitman, who's this character who he makes these dreadful movies like Terror Toy, which is, you know, very cheap Chucky knockoff, and everyone hates them, and he thinks that he's convinced that the one way to make his movies better is to make the gore in them more realistic. Now, to me, this is just a really interesting expression of what I think the motivating factor, the key motivating factor for this character is. It's basically, what if a filmmaker like Herschel Gordon Lewis actually was what people projected he was based on his films? If you knew nothing about Herschel Gordon Lewis except what he put on screen, that he was, like, possibly trying to corrupt people's youth, that he was basically trying to, like, that he was so perverse that, like, he was enacting what he put on screen at the time in real life, what would this guy look like? What would a psychotic break for this man look like? And that smash cut.
I don't know.
In that sense, there's a level of inherent arbitrariness to it, though. There's an inherent arbitrariness to the violence in the film, to its constant, like, cinematic illusions.
You mean like a guy being killed by a harpoon while sits on a bus?
Oh my god, that was genius. I love that. The harpoon scene is great because, Where is it? Scrolling through my notes. I have so many notes for this movie because it's so many good lines. Abel, where'd you get a harpoon? Harpoon store?
Harpoon store? The only reason that the harpoon was there was because the script initially called for that character to be killed in a boat.
No. I think he just wanted... My reading, I just said he wanted an excuse to make the Whitman character kill someone while yelling, "Nar, she blows!" Honestly, like, would you, or the fact that the suicide note, because he kills this guy in the first...
With a harpoon!
Yeah, yes, yes. He kills this guy only to give himself an alibi. So he basically, he adds an addendum to his suicide note, which already just says, typewritten on a little note card, "I'm going to kill myself." And then he adds in pencil, "With a harpoon!"
I don't know. Hold on. I just felt... just from the beginning, it just felt wrong to me with the screening of Terror Toy, which is just too blatantly bad, like, quote unquote. I mean, it's a film that isn't believable even as a film within a film. I mean, you have a woman with her eye getting gouged out, and it's a fucking softball-sized eye. I mean, it's just too blatantly awful.
But that's the thing.
It's blatantly incompetent.
I think it works on the level that it's completely arbitrary. It's not a Lewis homage. I mean, what is more ridiculous and, like, just hard to wrap your mind around than the idea of a killer toy? Like, it's just inherently absurd and inherently contextless. Like, and that's what I like about it. Like, the constant reference to, like, all these cinematic illusions that don't have any, like, grounding. Like, there's a Battleship Potemkin reference where his screenwriter, Alan, has a crack in his glasses. He asks, how would Lubitsch do it? There's, like, a Peeping Tom reference whenever we're looking through the point of view of the camera, which has a scope on it, or crosshairs. I'm sorry.
Right.
There's like good, the bad, and the ugly reference.
Where he's walking around in the poncho for absolutely no reason.
Yeah, and it's stuff like that that, like, to me, it's inspired basically on the level of, like, well, you have to accept the fact that his movies are, if you're in that universe, they're ruled absolutely by cynicism, by arbitrariness, by the explosive, like, violence that would later take hold in the slasher genre that he effectively are his, like, grandkids, thematic grandkids in the afterbirth of the Gordon Lewis films. But on that level, like, the fundamental nature of these films is their cynical detachment. And I think that's what's so great about it, because, like, it's totally riffing on that. Like, the idea that the only reference to 2000 Maniacs in the film that I caught was that there's a movie in the film called 1 Trillion Leaning Towers. I mean, like, why Leaning Towers? Why Maniacs? Why Hicks? And that's the beauty of it. It's, like, it's totally taking the whatever the fuck attitude of Lewis's films, and it's like, here, let's send that up.
Throw it out, yeah.
Yeah, like the movie posters in the that he has.
I did like the titles of a lot of the movies.
Lover, Take My Liver. And,
yes.
Dear God, Who Flushed My Flesh?
Yes, Who Flushed My Flesh is a good one.
Oh gosh, there are others. Oops, there goes my left arm.
See, I think 2001 Maniacs works. Not just as a point of reference, but as a film. I think Smash Cut kind of goes too far into... You need to know the point of the joke to get it.
I don't think that's true, though. Like, I think someone could look at it and just think of it basically in terms of what the world would look like to a crazed and totally embittered filmmaker, like what we imagine Lewis is really like. Like,
And I also have to say the whole side plot with the porno chick.
What's her name? Sasha Grey.
Thank you. The whole side plot with Sasha Grey and the private detective. I hated it.
I
wanted the private detective to get killed so hard.
You didn't even like the part where he the private detective makes a film within a film, and he has on the title credit sequence, which is a silent film, like a it says I have it right here. Where is it? He says it's a what's his first name? Something Dumont.
I have no idea. I don't care. Something Dumont.
Yeah, something Dumont. An Isaac Dumont joint. Yes, that's it. And it's like... it's so silly. Or the fact that he's running out of a theater where gas is pouring out, and he runs back in just to grab a popcorn.
But see that...
Or when he visualizes how it would look like if, when he died on the suicide note, if the guy actually did kill himself with a harpoon, and he's imagining, what would that look like? And you actually see a guy throw a harpoon in the air up, yes. And kill himself.
But see, it's like the popcorn gag, or the fact that he's showing a short film... making a blunt Hamlet reference after Hess has earlier in the film made a blunt Hamlet reference. Mm-hmm. It's just a lot of the film just strikes me as when it's not being random for the sake of being random, just too bluntly on the nose.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I would imagine you would have taken to that because, like, you're a trauma guy, and I think that trauma
I'm a Lloyd Kaufman guy. I'm not necessarily a trauma guy. Okay. A lot of what trauma puts out is fucking awful.
Right. But, I mean, I think...
For every teenage catgirls in Heat, there's about four or five Maniac Nurses Find Ecstasy.
But it's totally in the same line as something like the original Toxic Avenger, I think.
Not necessarily. I disagree entirely.
You have to look at it this way. Like, what I really like about the film is that, it takes... seriously, very seriously, the grievances of its character. Like, the fact is that Abel Whitman is totally upset with the complacency of TV and how that rules everything, how nobody shoots on
film
anymore, everything's on digital, the level of ridiculous criticism, which is totally dependent on the sources rather than actual arguments. It's this level of bitterness, abject bitterness that, I love the fact that it never steps away from that. And it's absolutely, the level of cynicism that I think is soaked through
Lewis's
cinema.
I think that all works thematically. I just don't think it plays very well on the screen. I think it's just kind of... It just kind of sits there, I think.
I just love the way that it ends. All my life I've had this perfect film in my head, and now I finally get the chance to see it, and then he gets shot in the head.
Again, but I've seen that gag before. I'm not with that exact dialogue, but
not with the build up to it.
I mean, hell, Hatchet 2 ends with that gag.
I know. No, it doesn't. That's not true. It doesn't have a filmmaker who's basically leaving his film.
It has that same sort of last hurrah type thing, and then all of a sudden, bam, and blackout.
But that's why it's different here. Here it's basically contextualized by the whole film, which is the film that he had in his head. It's the total realization of that level of well, I can't really put it on screen, so I might as well just do it, you know? Yeah. Just actually go out there and take it to the next level, which is actually using people's entrails and body parts in my filmmaking.
See, I don't... See, I think DeMarb has good ideas. I just don't think he quite knows how to express them. I guess in that regard, he's kind of like Abel Whitman.
Right. No, I don't know. I think DeMarb with this and Jesus Christ, Vampire Hunter, he's totally two for two for me. I think he's just tremendously talented.
I think he's one for three on me so far. Because, okay. Like I was telling you earlier, I also saw Harry Knuckles in the Pearl Necklace, which is...
A
20-minute film stretched to 120. It runs out of things to say real quick and just keeps going.
Right.
But
we should transition now to our Netflix grab bag. Yes, a couple of weeks ago, actually only 3 weeks ago, we had a really tight level of titles to choose from. I think I thought it was a very good selection. We had you chose basically as is. The hook behind the Netflix grab bag feature, one of four titles we randomly pulled out of either my queue or Steve's queue. This was taken from my Netflix queue. And you voted for which one you wanted us to cover. Because, you know, eventually with these Netflix queues, you just put stuff in there and you never get around to them.
Right.
And, you know, what better way to find something new than to just, you know, pick eeny, meeny, miny, moe and have someone else, you know, pull the trigger, basically.
As it were, yeah.
And the four choices we had last time were... Blake Edwards' Darling Lily, Swimming to Cambodia, the Jonathan Demme film, starring and all about the...
Spalding Gray.
Yeah, Spalding Gray's time in Cambodia. The Silent Partner, an Elliot Gould heist movie from the 70s. And the movie that you chose was Goyokin, a 1969 samurai movie by Hideo Gosha, the director of Onimasa and...
Sword of the Beast.
Sword of the Beast, Yakuza Wives. I tend to think that, for me, Gosha is a major artist that nobody's paying attention to and nobody's given his due. He's definitely very much influenced by Kurosawa. Like, his widescreen compositions and, like, the pensive nature of, like, the way that the characters think about their actions and they try to live based on, like this moral code. And they're disgusted by, like, what they see and their helplessness. That, especially in Goyokin, is very much taken from the Kurosawa samurai films. And it's kind of why I have such mixed feelings about the film. Because there's a part of me that really admires the level of craft to it. But go ahead, sorry.
I was going
to
say, just as a rejoinder to that, I wasn't really reminded of Kurosawa at all. Mm. The film that kept popping up for me was Kobayashi's Harakiri.
Okay.
Just in terms of, you know, the samurai code and, you know, the less than ethical applications of it and one rogue samurai kind of leaving the fold and coming back for revenge, that sort of thing.
But if I were to think of that in terms of comparison to Harakiri, I'd be that much more disappointed with it because that movie, Harakiri, has so much more of a dynamic nesting egg sort of narrative structure.
Well, let me also say that I'm not the biggest fan of Goyokin.
Yeah, I'm
kind of using the Harakiri comparison is where I feel it falls short.
Okay, it's basically the film starts with the population of Kurosaki, which is a small seaside town, is decimated literally overnight. Nobody knows why. This one girl who returns to the town finds everyone dead. Tatami mats are covering everyone's bodies. Their faces are contorted in pain. Their skin is like stretched taut.
And that sequence is quite gorgeous.
It's a beautifully shot scene.
Ending in that moment with the crows turning into the writing symbols.
Oh yeah, or bursting in and out of like the paper screens,
paper windows.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful and just very haunting scene.
Yeah.
And one of the many reasons why I think Gosha is one of the few people that knows exactly how to use slow motion photography. Mm-hmm. He knows exactly how to do it. He films it beautifully. These gorgeous widescreen compositions, which I think are directly indebted to Kurosawa's films. But the plot is that from that point on, 5 years later, I think, Waki Saka, played by Tatsuya Nakadai, who would work with Gosha on a couple other movies, including Onimasa, he was part of this big swindle that basically these men that were they weren't authorized by the shogunate, but they basically slaughtered the entire town.
They were kind of actually acting independently of the shogunate because they knew they weren't going to be able to meet their tax duties.
Yes.
That were to be paid to the shogunate.
So they killed this entire town because this town happened to find a shipwreck with all this gold in it, and they offered to give it back to the shogunate. And the men that came to collect said, well, wait a minute. We can make our local town's budget deficit by killing these people and taking the money for ourselves.
But given how events transpire in the film, there's a question about whether or not that shipwreck was actually set up from the beginning.
Right. Which is where the movie loses me, honestly. But back to this idea, like, the desperation, and I think it's an inherently existential desperation that Gosha sets up, and this is kind of what I like about it, is phrased in the way that all these characters, these killers, basically, use very technical jargon. They talk of deficits and the amount of grain raised by a group, amount of gold, of revenue, different varieties and quantities of things. It sort of dehumanizes the drama.
I hate to say it, but another film that kept coming to mind when, you know, with all this talk of deficits and taxes and things, it kept coming to mind the flack that George Lucas caught for basing Episode One around basically a tax dispute.
Oh, okay.
And because Lucas was always a huge fan of Japanese cinema in the 60s and 70s. I mean, he produced Kajimusha, for Christ's sake.
Right.
So this is...
I thought Coppola was involved in that, too. But
I think he was, too. But okay. The point is that I can understand from a kind of a cracked perspective how Lucas may have been trying to pay homage to those sorts of plots.
Right.
Phantom Menace is just, you know, he's a terrible writer, so... But anyway.
But yeah, the effect of it basically is that Gosha wants us to get totally desensitized by the films, not by its violence, but by its lack of violence, by its total asexual,
violent nature. It's reduction of humanity to a number.
Right.
Or a cog in a wheel.
And basically
part of a system.
The way to match the debits and credits in that is that you have got to kill a lot of people and take the gold. And that's where Wakisaka's character comes in and tries to sort of make that corrupt system bright again.
Yeah. Well, his disenchantment came from when he has that speech where he realizes that as a samurai, he's supposed to be fighting for the small guys. And upon seeing this massacre, he realizes that what he's doing here is, you know, essentially the exact opposite of that. So he's kind of the idea of humanity fighting against this governmental depersonalization.
Right. Which is why I think the quote of the movie is where he's the victim of... The girl that first discovers the bodies 5 years ago asks him why he doesn't carry a sword around. And he says, what's the point of having a sword if you don't deserve to live?
I'm already dead.
Exactly. And better yet, it basically implies... I'm not going to take life if I don't even want mine.
Yeah.
And that, I think, in a roundabout way, brings me to why I'm reluctant to recommend this movie, because they don't use their swords. It is a long and thoughtful, but pensive and at times rather ponderous movie, because it's basically a lot of waiting for the characters to justify the fact that they're doing nothing.
There becomes a point in the 2-hour-plus running time where it's set...
It was only 2 hours,
though? 2 hours and 5 minutes.
Oh, 2 hours plus.
Say, that's plus.
You're fine.
But, you know, there comes a time where you realize that everything that can be said thematically and narratively from this stasis has been said.
Right.
And yet the stasis still isn't breaking.
Right, and I think that's partly one of the reasons why Gosha is, as an auteur, or as a director, or whatever, is so slow in getting the recognition he deserves, because, first of all, he's trapped in that weird state of being a genre filmmaker that's a lot smarter than his peers, and he knows it, and his movies move with the sluggishness of a filmmaker that's like, I'm doing something different than you! But, like, the other thing is that, like, what's difficult about him is that he just doesn't have the sea legs to pull that level of intelligence off. Like, the brains of the film and the ballsiness of it and the way that it just is a very smart variation on a theme is definitely there. But, like, I just, in execution, it's only fitfully satisfying.
Yeah. Especially early on, he gets a lot of mileage out of, like, the use of the crows.
Mm-hmm.
Especially that one image early on, where a crow, or a couple of crows are feeding off a dead crow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, you want to talk about a thematically loaded image right there.
Yeah.
But, you know, then, you know, when you know, and the, I like the characters of the woman who survives the massacre and her brother, especially in how the female, that woman character is conceived as a lot stronger than a lot of the contemporaneous filmmakers would have made her.
Yeah, the way that she follows him at the end,
and she even saves his bacon in the abandoned town where he's stuck in the building's burning, and she and her brother go and get the two warring clans that are fighting over this town to come in and assault each other.
Right.
So,
but the way that she follows him at the end is like totally, it's an image that could, in a weaker director's hands, look like
maudlin.
Yeah, not just maudlin, but it looks like a pacification of a rather fierce character.
Yeah.
And it's not, because like there's a distance between the two that is absolutely maintained.
Yes.
He never looks back as if to basically assure himself or assure her that he knows that she's there.
Right.
They just happen to be going in the same place, and nothing really needs to be said between the two. And the image is just gorgeous because, like, it's realized with that beautiful like wind sweeping across that like the snowy.
I don't think that's that woman though.
It isn't? No, I thought it was.
I think that's the other woman, the sister of the head prefect or whatever it is, the main villain of the piece.
Oh, fuck. Yeah. There goes that theory.
Yeah, sorry, dude. No, because he left the village woman behind, and as he's walking along, the other woman goes to follow him. The unspoken thing being that, you know, they had a history before he left the society,
right?
Because, you know, the villain tries to use his sister as a bribe to get him out of the situation, get him out of the way.
I still think the power dynamic between those two characters is there, even if it's doesn't necessarily.
Well, no, I don't disagree with you there. I just think you know, that one image is it's not doing what I think you think it's doing is all.
But, yeah.
But to bring up the character of the sister of the villain, I think she's kind of the weakest point of the film.
Yeah,
because they introduce her, and then they have that one scene where she tries to bribe him with the gold to go away, and then they don't really know what to do with her after that. So they keep bringing her back, and it's just to diminishing returns each time, and it becomes part of the film's, I guess, repetitive nature in its second half, and it just, yeah. But before it gets to its big action set piece, it has a lot of ground to cover, and some of the ground it covers a little too well, in my opinion.
I think we should probably wrap this up there and tell you what the titles for next week's or next month's Netflix grab bag are. Yes. This time we're choosing from Steve's regular queue, not the instant queue.
Yeah.
And what are the choices?
We've got some pretty cool choices this time around. We've got Island Fury, which is an obscure 1980s horror film that was initially titled, what was it, They Eat Only Babies or something like that? I mean, it's got this incredibly lurid title that isn't being used on the DVD, and I don't know why, because if that was its title, I would have watched it already. Then we have The Love Parade, old Lubitsch silent.
Yes.
Love Affair, or The Case of the Missing Switchboard Operator, which is the debut film from Dusan Makhachev.
Amazed that you can pronounce that.
I'm pretty sure I said that right.
I'm amazed.
You
can't see this, podcasters, but I am patting him on the back like a boss.
Yeah. Dusan, of course, being the fellow who would later go on to make a WR, Mysteries of the Organism, and
Sweet
Movie, which is pretty incredible. And the fourth one is Nine Deaths of the Ninja, which I don't need to tell you anything about. You hear the title, that's what it's about, damn it.
Is it a sequel to Revenge of the Ninja?
It's not related at all. It's a Canadian knockoff of those movies.
Have we decided, by the way, what we're doing our next podcast on, by the way?
I think it's pretty open, actually. So if anybody out there listening to the three people we apparently podcast this for...
Yay!
Want to suggest an idea. And incidentally, if you all give us your names, we'll thank you individually on the next podcast.
Oh, yeah. We may even send you a DVD of something.
We might. I can't promise it'll be something pleasant, though.
Yeah.
I've got this DVD of Super Hornio Brothers I need to get rid of.
I gotta unload this thing on somebody.
So Island Fury, The Love Parade.
You've already forgotten it, too.
Love Affair, or Nine Deaths of the Ninja. So
vote for it, love it, anticipate it. And yes. On that note, love, power, and soul. I got that middle one wrong, but anyway. As Don
Love,
Cornelius,
power, and soul?
Don Cornelius is signing off, no?
I have no idea, man.
You've never watched Soul Train?
No, I'm afraid I haven't.
Anyway.
Soul Train was usually my cue to turn off the TV when the Saturday morning cartoons were over.
The Soul Train! Anyway, on that note, bye.